This week on COVID Race and Democracy.
The sanctions, you really understand what a brutal weapon, because it's a crisis that hits the most vulnerable. It creates millions of small personal crises. Essential medicines for diabetes, for high blood pressure, for small infections, a broken bone can be a death penalty.
Sarah Flounders on the impact of sanctions worldwide.
It's important to understand that not only are nations impacted, but that the capitalist enemy uses sanctions to intervene domestically into the internal politics, into the class forces, the social relationships in particular states.
Ajama Baraka on sanctions as class warfare in Latin America.
Since February this year, the imperialist powers of the US, Canada, the European Union, and Britain have imposed massive, unprecedented, unilateral, and illegal sanctions against Russia. These sanctions are very wide-ranging. Russia's been cut out of SWIFT, which is the global messaging network for international payments, in order to try and cripple the Russian economy.
Carlos Martinez on sanctions and the new Cold War. From Pacifica Radio, this is COVID, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Today we're presenting highlights from the Sanctions Kill Coalition's webinar on the new anthology, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy, which was held on December 10. Here's the book's editor, Sarah Flounders.
I want to say I have visited so many different countries over the years of organizing opposition to U.S. wars, and they were each country suffering the total dislocation of U.S. sanctions. And the sanctions, you really understand what a brutal weapon, because it's a crisis that hits the most vulnerable. It creates millions of small personal crises. Essential medicines for diabetes, for high blood pressure, for small infections, a broken bone can be a death penalty. Polluted, untreated water, because there's no chlorine, is deadly. And so are multi-story buildings, suddenly without elevators or water pumps. Can't flush the toilet. You have no clean, fresh water. And when the U.S. government seizes the funds in the national treasury, it becomes impossible to pay teachers or medical staff or infrastructure. Industries are shut down. It's a brutal form of war, and it is like an anti-personnel bomb going off in every home. It's meant to divide people in frantic waves, and it creates waves of refugees and desperate migrants. In international law, the targeting of civilians is always and totally off limits, even in a shooting war, in the midst of a war. And yet, U.S. imperialism has perfected this form of siege warfare that deliberately targets civilians, and the most vulnerable civilians, the young, the old, the chronically sick, the poorest. I've seen it firsthand in Iraq, US and UN sanctions, 500,000 deaths of children under 5 years of age, no count even of the sick or the aged. I've seen the impact of US sanctions in Lebanon, Sudan, in Syria, with a third of the population displaced refugees, in Gaza's refugee camps, in Venezuela that built free healthcare system. There were small health clinics on almost every street in dense urban areas that were dispensing basic medications, monitoring blood pressure and diet. And suddenly, when the U.S. sanctions hit, the shelves were bare. There was not a gauze pad or an aspirin. This is what sanctions does. Cuba, who provides more medical staff than the World Health Organization in Africa, has done incredible programs in medical research but they couldn't deliver to their own population the COVID vaccine they had developed without an international campaign to send syringes. They couldn't buy syringes. U.S. government imposes sanctions, and they do so through all different government arms, by first using the media to promote a hysterical campaign that the targeted country is a national security threat. Even Nicaragua was declared a national security threat, if you can imagine. Now, how Cuba or Nicaragua are national security threats to U.S., think about it. Little Nicaragua is a threat to U.S. imperialist domination because it's offering its people free health care and free education. Their success exposes what U.S. is not doing and what it could be doing in solving real problems. The sanctions are racist. They overwhelmingly target people of color in the global South, and sanctions come back and hit us here. We had a program this week in the South Bronx, the poorest county in the U.S., and it was at Hostos Community College, a college with the largest number of unhoused students who live in shelters, who have no address. The students had just held a protest because the college hasn't had a cafeteria in 3 years. Why? There's no money, and the cafeteria just couldn't operate without making a profit. So these students understood so well the impact of sanctions. They wrote messages about what the book meant to them. These are the concrete links we have to make. There's funds for endless war that's profitable. There's funds for 800 US military bases, for NATO expansion, an additional $60 billion, and then $20 billion more and $30 billion more for US-NATO war in Ukraine, but a mere $20 billion for student loan cancellation, that just isn't there. Now, there are enormous changes rumbling below our feet, and the sanctions policy is a real cause of this. The US empire is suddenly finding it's not all powerful. The 800 military bases, the expanded NATO military machine, and more than 60 US invasions since World War II. The U.S. dollar is a world currency. It's a preferred weapon in using its vast economic power to strangle opposition. Every political decision in the capitalist U.S. economy is driven by profit to enforce its global position. But the ability of the U.S. to enforce global domination is slipping. It's proof of its inability to enforce the devastating sanctions, the thousands of new sanctions on Russia and on China. The global South, the countries of Africa, Latin America, most of the countries of Asia, the formerly colonized world, are not complying with these thousands of sanctions imposed by the US and the European nations, the NATO members, the sanctions especially imposed on Russia. They need the grain, the energy, the resources, and the ability of the United States to create economic chaos has not succeeded. It is a shock to the powers that be here. Now, this is not the end of US imperialism, but it is a sign of the decay, the erosion of power, the ability of many countries to find ways to connect with each other despite US power. This is a new period. The U.S. sanctions have boomeranged. They've hit hard, especially the European countries. They've cut themselves off at U.S. demand, cut themselves off from cheap gas traded with Russia, and they are devastating the European economies. It's also impacting the U.S. economy right here. But we can see in Britain where they talk about the average person now having to choose between heating and eating. What a choice. The increased sanctions on China have a destructive impact on science and technology on a global scale. But cooperation is expanding among these sanctioned countries. We can look at the BRICS Plus, new levels of cooperation and trade agreements, the Belt and Road, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Problems are solved by cooperation and not by endless war and sanctions. They're solved by respect for sovereignty and independence and respect for different development paths, for multilateralism versus US hegemony. Now, where do we stand in all of this? Working people right here need their own voice. We can't be chained to the corporate media and the capitalist threats. There are new agreements this week with China and the Gulf states and all the Arab countries. There's excited talk of international currency involving the yuan and the ruble and the rupee. And all of this challenges the almighty US dollar. So the world is changing rapidly, and that's what we're discussing today. And that's what several of the authors who are here with us today are going to be talking in more detail.
That was Sarah Flounders, editor of the new anthology, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. Next, we'll hear from Erica Jung on sanctions on the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, introduced by Sarah Flounders.
First up, as our opening speaker, we want to call on Erica Jung. Erica organizes with the No-Do-Toll for Korean Community Development. She organizes and speaks on the continuing U.S. threats on Korea, organizes solidarity with North Korea. And her chapter in the book is Korea, DPRK, Surviving U.S.-UN Sanctions and Military Threats. So, Erica, please join us.
All right. Thank you so much, Sarah, and a big thank you to the Sanctions Kill campaign. Now, earlier this month, the U.S., South Korea, and Japan imposed coordinated unilateral sanctions against North Korea after the U.S. failed to levy new international sanctions against North Korea, also known by its official name, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, or the DPRK, through the UN Security Council. The US has also blacklisted three members of the Workers' Party of Korea for allegedly helping the DPRK's development of weapons of mass destruction and ballistic missiles. Shortly after, South Korea issued its own round of sanctions, targeting eight individuals and seven companies for supposedly contributing to the DPRK's weapons programs. Japan also designated three entities and an individual for new sanctions. The U.S. has imposed these sanctions in response to North Korea's missile launches this past year. North Korea is being cast as a pariah state, but in reality, the North Korean development of nuclear weapons is a strategy of deterrence against U.S. imperial aggression. The U.S. has occupied and demonized Korea ever since it achieved its independence from Imperial Japan. During the Korean War, U.S. forces killed 3 to 5 million Koreans. This is a number that essentially amounts to genocide. The U.S. dropped more aerial bombs on North Korea than it did in the entire Pacific theater of World War II. And to this day, the Korean War is not over, thanks to U.S. interest in keeping Korea divided. The ceasefire signed in 1953 did not end the war. In fact, the U.S. kept almost 1,000 nuclear missiles in South Korea pointed at the North for almost 50 years. And to this day, the U.S. continues to occupy the South with almost 30,000 soldiers and over 70 military bases under the pretense of a North Korean threat and conducts joint military exercises with neighboring countries. Just this past year in August, the U.S. and South Korea began live military exercises against North Korea after a four-year pause, dramatically escalating tensions on the peninsula. These exercises can involve up to 300,000 soldiers and often rehearse invasions of North Korea, including decapitation exercises to assassinate North Korean leaders. U.S. military exercises also expand beyond Korea to all of Asia. In the same summer, the U.S. gathered 25 countries for the RIMPAC military exercises in a clear show of force against China and North Korea. In the last few months alone, the U.S. and South Korea launched their largest ever air drills through Operation Vigilant Storm, which involved over 240 aircraft and B-1B supersonic stealth bombers near the DMZ. Thus, calls for dialogue and diplomacy are ultimately empty and meaningless when the U.S. ramps up its own military presence in a peninsula it has no business being in. Everything the U.S. has done in Korea has been for its own strategic geopolitical interests, which rely on division and thereby have a vested interest in preventing national liberation and reunification. And while sanctions are just one part of the imperialist playbook, their effects can be devastating. One of the most sanctioned countries in the world, North Korea can't trade with other countries, receive international loans, or import fuel or much of anything else. From agriculture to industry, sanctions impact all aspects of life in North Korea. Most things North Koreans need, they have to produce for themselves. There is no getting it from somewhere else. Sanctions impact water, sanitation, hygiene, and healthcare infrastructure. According to UNICEF, over 9.75 million people do not have access to safely managed drinking water. Crucially, one of the many types of items that North Korea is banned from importing due to sanctions is water sanitation equipment. Under sanctions, seeds, fertilizers, and agricultural equipment and other types of machinery are banned. And contrary to popular narratives that claim North Korea's government is intentionally withholding food from its population, food insecurity in the country is driven by a lack of access to modern agricultural equipment and techniques, and is amplified by natural disasters and the impacts of climate change. In fact, North Korea has a public food distribution system, but it's unable to access the necessary agricultural imports from the world market. Sanctions also hugely affect the quality of healthcare available in North Korea. North Korea has a national public healthcare system that provides medical care to everyone free of charge. In general, its health indicators are much higher than in countries with comparably sized economies. However, because of sanctions, North Korea's healthcare system faces shortages of medicine and equipment that impact its ability to treat many preventable diseases. This is the reason why, for instance, up to 37% of deaths among children under 5 are caused by pneumonia and diarrhea. Under UN sanctions, all metal items are banned. Think about what that means. Metal is everywhere. Sterilizers, ambulances, medical appliances, x-ray machines, operating tables, hospital beds, water filters, metal tubes, pipes, pipe fittings. The list is endless. These kinds of items could be used to prevent and treat common health problems in North Korea. If the basis of sanctions and U.S. aggression against North Korea is really a concern for human rights, one might wonder why these sanctions seem to so obviously trample on North Koreans' right to live. And while the U.S. makes exemptions on a case-by-case basis for humanitarian aid, applicants for these exemptions, mainly international and non-governmental organizations, face significant challenges, from long wait times for review and approval of exemption requests to unrealistic shipping requirements. These administrative barriers to humanitarian aid have had fatal consequences. In just 2018, delays and funding shortfalls resulted in an estimated 3,968 preventable deaths. The U.S. condemns human rights in North Korea, yet in the same breath, it violates those very rights by imposing deadly sanctions. The U.S. claims to want to end the Korean War, yet in the same breath, the U.S. imposes greater sanctions as an act of warfare, knowing full well that North Korea sees lifting sanctions as a precondition to negotiations to ending the war. We must not be fooled by the rhetoric of the United States, but look instead at its actions. And despite these repressive U.S. policies, North Korea has resisted sanctions and managed to hold its own and provide for its people. The North Korean people themselves continue to stay resilient and adapt to the many challenges they face through remarkable advancements in agriculture, energy, and textile and steel production. As the Korean War continues, U.S. sanctions against North Korea serve as a direct act of warfare, prolonging division and preventing reunification against the Korean people's wishes. Since the outbreak of the Korean War in 1950, the U.S. has sanctioned the country's top export industries and any financial transactions involving the country. Collectively, both UN sanctions and unilateral U.S. sanctions have resulted in an almost total ban on DPRK-related trade, investment, and financial transactions. The international community must accept the sovereignty of North Korea and provide support rather than isolate, vilify, or strong-arm them. In order to move forward with reunification, we must promote peace and cooperation between the Koreas and reject U.S. imperialism in all forms. As long as they exist, sanctions will continue to serve as a major barrier to renewing peace talks between the two Koreas. We must organize against imperialist sanctions in order to achieve peace, liberation, and reunification in Korea.
That was Erica Jung, author of Korea, DPRK, Surviving U.S.-UN Sanctions and Military Threats, in the new anthology, Sanctions, a Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. This is Covered Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. Today we're presenting highlights from the Sanctions Kill Coalition's webinar on the new anthology, Sanctions, a Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy, which was held on December 10. Next, we'll hear from Ajamu Baraka, National Coordinator of the Black Alliance for Peace, introduced by Sarah Flounders.
Ajamu Baraka, who's a well-known writer, thinker, who coordinates the Black Alliance for Peace. Ajamu is co-director of the U.S. Peace Council and an essential part of the administrative committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition. Ajamu is speaking to us from Colombia, and his chapter in the book is Class Warfare and Socialist Resistance in Latin America. Ajamu.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah. And thank everyone for pulling this very important conversation together today, including the United National Anti-War Coalition, of course, International Action Center. It's ironic, I guess, that this conversation is happening today, December 10th, which is celebrated around the world, if not in the U.S., as the International Human Rights Day. Ironic in the sense that what we are talking about and what we will further explore is the systematic attempt on the part of the U.S. settler colonial state to deny the most elementary human rights to masses of people in this country and around the world. It's important to note that the U.S. is the leader of the Western Bloc, and its objective is to maintain the global hegemony of the pan-European white supremacist colonial capitalist patriarchy that emerged in 1492 and represents the hegemonic force that we are all struggling against today. In order to maintain that hegemony, they have decided that they are going to engage in open forms of warfare. And it's important to note that this sanction weapon is, in fact, a weapon of war. It has devastating consequences for societies throughout the world, and it results in death and destruction in a real way. So bringing attention to this is important, because it's important for us to understand the multidimensional weapons that are used by Western imperialism to maintain this hegemony. In order for us to develop the strategies we have to develop in order not only to resist, but to defeat this imperialist monster. Sanctions is a part of hybrid war. And one of the most important elements of this hybrid war helps to continue public support, at least domestically, for the sanction regime and for the other various forms of repressive activity that the settler state engages in, is the rationale, the justification for it, the ability of the enemy to create an ideological framework that allows for the public to support these methods of warfare. It's important also to understand that in this warfare that's being waged against us, this is a warfare being waged not only against nations, but against peoples and classes, that the sanctioned weapon is a weapon in the class struggle. And that is what I touched on in my chapter in this book. We're not going to go through all of the elements of that, but it's important to understand that not only are nations impacted, but that the capitalist enemy uses sanctions to intervene domestically into the internal politics, into the class forces, the social relationships in particular states. And we have multiple examples of that. So it's important to understand that this is part of the international class struggle. This sanction regime, again, is about dominance, is about hegemony. And this settler colonial regime in the US is committed to maintaining that hegemony. And that's why when we look at Latin America, and we look at how sanctions are used in Latin America, we can understand why they will target Nicaragua, Cuba, or Venezuela, small developing nations as threats to U.S. national security. And the reason why they target those states is not because anyone from those states are going to invade the U.S. and overthrow the capitalist state. It is the example that these states represent, that these states are involved in a people-centered process to transform their societies, that they are developing their societies on different lines of values that are contrary to the values that are hegemonic within the U.S. They are committed to the basic human rights that people should be able to experience, like housing, access to medical care, food, clean water, that they are building this process within a process where they are maintaining peaceful relationships among themselves until they are impacted by the interference and interventions of this criminal state. So this is a component of class war. And therefore, we have to, in our responses, understand that why it's important for us to analyze and to be able to explain how sanctions are part of this effort to maintain hegemony. We have to be able to be in a place to respond and to struggle against this process. That this one-sided war being waged against us has to be reversed. So my friends, we say in the Black Alliance of Peace that we cannot just sell wolf tickets, that you're not going to just shout at imperialism and it crumbles. You have to actively organize and struggle against it. This is the war that we are involved in. This is the historical task that we have. It is a task and a responsibility, my friends, that we have to take up, and we cannot afford to lose. So thank you, my friends. Thank you for this great event. Please go to theblackalliance of peace.com to see the statement that we put out today on International Human Rights Day. Please find ways to support this work. And let's all of us understand that we are involved in a war that we have to win. All power to the people.
That was Ajamu Baraka, author of Class Warfare and Socialist Resistance in Latin America, in the new anthology, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. Next, we'll hear from Judy Bello, introduced by Sarah Flounders.
Next up is Judy Bello, who is running also the tech for today's webinar and is the design and production coordinator of this book and has contributed hundreds of hours to this project. Judy is on the administrative committee of the United National Anti-War Coalition, is part of the Sanctions Kill campaign, is on the board of the Syria Support Movement, and is the webmaster for countless projects and has participated in solidarity delegations to Syria and Iran. So Judy, please.
All right, thank you, Sarah. Today, I want to talk about the effects of US sanctions or unilateral coercive measures on the developing nations in the Middle East. The group of countries I'm going to talk about, Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and critically, Palestine, can be referred to as the axis of resistance. They are the axis of resistance to the Israeli occupation of Palestine and to Western imperialism. In 1948, Israeli militias occupied Palestine. Many people were killed, more were driven from their homes, and their property was stolen. The remainder have suffered increasingly barbaric oppression over the years, including the destruction of property, arbitrary imprisonment, murders, and massacres. Today, the Gaza Strip is completely walled off from Israel, and the people are banned from the sea. Building materials are not allowed, and the Israelis say that they are keeping the Palestinians on a diet by only allowing subsistence level of foodstuff to be brought in. Israel has stolen the water from the Palestinian aquifer, as well as the water from the Syrian Golan. While Palestinians go without water for drinking and bathing, Israeli settlers have ostentatious swimming pools a few miles away. While the homes of Gazan people are razed through military bombardment, those living in the West Bank and Jerusalem routinely have their houses torn down and their property confiscated by Israeli authorities. In 2006, U.S. sanctions banned companies from doing business with the Palestinian Authority. Public schools and hospitals, along with other government services, were targeted by these sanctions. Meanwhile, individual members of the PA were enriched under the table, so they will enforce the Israeli and U.S. policies. Prior to the Second World War, Syria, Lebanon, and Palestine formed a single unit within the Ottoman Empire, Greater Syria, or al-Shams. Within this area, there are deep ties of kinship and economic dependencies. Shifting gears just a little, in 1953, I'm going to follow my timeline, the United States supported a coup in Iran, which ended an emerging democracy and placed Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, the son of a previous dictator, on the throne, while sweeping aside the Majlis, or parliament, and Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who had dared to nationalize their oil wells. After 1978, when the Islamic Republic replaced the Western puppet government of the Shah, the first sanctions were placed on Iran. In 1980, the U.S. connived with their Iraqi ally to begin a decade-long war of aggression against Iran. During the war, the United States and their European allies provided weapons to Iraq, including chemicals to make sarin and mustard gas. At the same time, forbidding anyone from trading with Iran. Although Iran won the war in the end and maintained the integrity of its borders, it was left with millions of dead and wounded soldiers and civilians and damaged civilian infrastructure. Their oil refineries, a primary resource, were destroyed. The U.S. increased their sanctions at this point, making it difficult to recover from the war. When I was there in 2007, most of the oil refineries had yet to be repaired. When Iraq's Saddam Hussein floated the idea of invading neighboring Kuwait to recoup some of his losses, he wasn't discouraged. When he made his move, the U.S. destroyed most of his army in a massive display of force and went on to destroy a great deal of civilian infrastructure in the country. They then instituted severe sanctions on imports of medical supplies, foodstuffs, and equipment to restore the destroyed infrastructure in Iraq. The result was famine and disease across the country. water, sanitation plants, and electrical power plants were not able to get the parts for repairs. Hospitals were unable to provide medicines. This situation led to Secretary of State Madeleine Albright's infamous response on being informed that over 500,000 children had died in Iraq due to these U.S. sanctions. Asked if it was worth it, she said that indeed she thought it was. In 1979, Syria, this is around the same time as the Islamic Republic began. In 1979, Syria, which has a large Palestinian population, was sanctioned by the U.S. as a state sponsor of terrorism. Syria was also the only country that supported Iran in the Iran-Iraq War. The initial sanctions on Syria were bearable as it was rich in resources and Hafez Assad provided a great deal of social support to the people while enforcing a policy of secularism, providing for equal opportunities in business and government and personal security for a highly diverse population. New sanctions placed on Syria in 2004 due to the Iran-Iraq War caused the beginnings of a buildup of unrest among the poor. In early 2011, color revolution-style Arab Spring protests arose across Syria, which formed the basis for a U.S.-fueled proxy war fought by terrorists from across the Middle East and around the globe. The war spilled over into Iraq, where Mosul was razed by U.S. bombers targeting ISIS prior to their move to Syria in 2014. And it spilled over into Lebanon, where terrorist groups wreaked havoc, particularly in conservative Sunni cities in the north. Eventually, Hezbollah came to Syria's assistance out of self-defense. Today, following a fierce 10-year proxy war, Syria has one-third of its territory occupied by the U.S. and its allies. Turkish-backed terrorists continue to control Syria's Idlib province, while Israel has annexed the Golan and routinely bombs Syrian territory from there. A proxy force led by the U.S. allied Kurds administers an area in the northeast of the country, which includes most of Syria's oil wells, their wheat-producing region, and a significant water source, the Euphrates. The area is protected by approximately 1,000 U.S. soldiers. With the country devastated by bombing raids and terrorist attacks, the U.S. placed new sanctions on Syria. These sanctions, ironically defined by the U.S. CSER Civilian Protection Act, include what are called secondary sanctions, which punish any country or business that provides any support to the primary sanctioned country. Meanwhile, the CSER sanctions are specifically tailored to prohibit reconstruction in Syria. They have not only destroyed the Syrian economy, but in conjunction with the theft of Syrian oil and wheat resources, they have devastated the population. Due to the secondary sanctions, international companies are afraid to provide any resources due to the fear of U.S. retaliation. Since Syrian banking and much of their import-export business was either directly with Lebanon or processed through Lebanese banks, the secondary sanctions on Syria brought down the already fragile and corrupt economy of Lebanon as well. And with the collapse of the banks in Lebanon, the equally unstable and corrupt government has collapsed as well. Elena Duhan, the United Nations Rapporteur on Secondary Sanctions, recently visited Syria. On her return, she demanded that the sanctions on Syria be lifted immediately. The Syrian pound has been devalued by 1,000%, so that their money has no value outside the country. There is a wave of cholera across the country due to the failure of sanitation and water purification facilities. Electricity is reduced to 2 or 4 hours a day for most people. They are cold and hungry. Refugees remain homeless. Manufacturing is shut down. Hospitals cannot get the 24-hour electrical supply necessary to run ventilators and other life support equipment. They don't have anesthetics to do surgeries. Terms like universal free medical care and education have little meaning in this context. Syria, with its money devalued to near zero, must now buy the heating oil and wheat it used to produce on its own. According to Elena Doohan, even the United Nations has trouble providing aid to Syria. When I was in Syria at the height of the war, there was food to eat and also to feed the population of displaced people. There was electricity in Damascus anyway, full time. Terrorists attacked water and energy supplies, which were soon repaired. Meanwhile, the Syrian government continued to supply power and other resources, even to terrorist-occupied regions, because these resources are necessary to support the civilian population. Sanctions, more rightfully called unilateral coercive measures, are a form of siege warfare. They are not a kinder, gentler form of inducement, but rather a brutal war on the civilian population of a country. The U.S. uses these methods without mercy. The term hybrid warfare seems clever and new, but aggressive imperialist countries have been waging wars of this sort on smaller ones for millennia. It is barbaric and despicable.
That was Judy Bellow, author of Deadly New Sanctions on Syria, in the new anthology, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. This is COVID Race and Democracy. I'm your host, Ann Garrison. You're listening to highlights from the Sanctions Kill Coalition's webinar on the new anthology, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy, which was held on December 10. Next, we'll hear from Carlos Martinez, introduced by Sarah Flounders.
Carlos Martinez is our next speaker, and we want to welcome Carlos, who's speaking to us from London. Carlos is a writer and a campaigner, the co-editor of the Friends of Socialist China. He's a co-founder of the No Cold War and a member of the International Manifesto Group's coordinating committee. Carlos Martinez's chapter is Sanctions in a New Cold War on China. But we asked Carlos today to discuss the U.S.-NATO war on Russia, a topic where that he's also spoken and written on extensively.
Thank you so much, Sarah, for that very kind introduction. Since February this year, the imperialist powers of the US, Canada, the European Union, and Britain have imposed massive, unprecedented, unilateral, and illegal sanctions against Russia. These sanctions are very wide-ranging. Russia's been cut out of SWIFT, which is the global messaging network for international payments, in order to try and cripple the Russian economy. Russian banks have had their assets frozen, over $1 trillion worth of assets. Biden ordered a ban on Russian energy imports to the US. Easy enough for him to do, given that the US was importing precious little Russian energy in the first place. But the story in Europe is much more complicated. Germany, for example, has been reliant on Russian energy for more than 50 years. Now, however, it's been cajoled into suspending the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. The European Union claims it's working towards ending its energy reliance on Russia. The G7 countries have just agreed on a price cap of $60 per barrel for Russian oil, which is more or less equal to the cost of production. This is another flagrant violation of international law and all the rules and norms governing global trade. And just as a side note, it's kind of interesting to observe here that no countries whatsoever were sanctioned as a result of the West's genocidal wars on Iraq or Afghanistan or Libya or Yugoslavia. You know, there's this liberal narrative going around that, well, Russia's invaded another country and, you know, we've got to do something, therefore sanctions are justified. Even if you accept that argument, and obviously you shouldn't, you should at least ask why these rules don't apply when it's the US and its allies that are doing the invading. So continuing, this economic war on Russia is having a hugely negative effect on Europe, which is experiencing an increasingly severe cost of living crisis. Energy prices have gone through the roof. Food prices have gone through the roof. Britain's inflation is running at over 11%. So wages are declining rapidly in real terms. Meanwhile, we're going into a cold winter in which literally millions of people are going to have to make that terrible choice that Sarah referenced earlier between eating and heating. The Guardian journalist Simon Jenkins, not a progressive by any reasonable definition, wrote recently that sanctions against Russia are, quote, the most ill-conceived and counterproductive policy in recent international history. World energy prices are rocketing, inflation is soaring, supply chains are chaotic, and millions are being starved of gas, grain, and fertilizer. By the way, another side effect of these sanctions and coercive measures is that Europeans have basically stopped even talking about climate change. Europe reducing its dependence on Russian natural gas doesn't mean shifting to low emissions energy sources. It means buying huge quantities of fracked shale gas from the United States. There is nothing green about that. Meanwhile, Germany's coal usage is up 17% on last year. It's reopening coal mines, as is France. Britain's just announced that it's going to build a new coal mine. You've got the sixth richest country in the world, the first country to colonize the atmosphere with its own industrial revolution, is now ramping up production of the most polluting fossil fuel. So this whole project is essentially directed towards propping up the short-term interests of US imperialism alone to the detriment of all humanity. And that's parallel to the entire new Cold War project, which is led by the US and which is directed against Russia, against China, against Iran, against Cuba, against Venezuela, against the whole global South. You know, the corner of Biden's foreign policy has been to essentially recreate the Cold War alliance, you know, when the freedom-loving West united under US leadership against the evil commies of the East. When we talk about the new Cold War, to be honest, to a quite significant degree, we're really talking about a century-old war to preserve, to consolidate, to expand the imperialist world system. The war of intervention in Russia from 1918, when the US, Britain, France, and others joined forces with the proto-fascist white Russians to try and overturn the Russian Revolution. The never-ending attempts to undermine the socialist world and to impose neo-colonial domination in Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, the Caribbean. The Korean War, the Vietnam War, the Contra War in Nicaragua. Regime change operations and military dictatorships in Brazil, in Indonesia, in Chile and elsewhere. The West's support for apartheid regimes throughout Southern Africa. And now Biden is looking to get the band back together, to revive that same project, a hybrid war against socialism, against sovereignty, and against multipolarity. It's a manifestation of the Project for a New American Century. Now, that was a neocon project, a neocon concept, a Rumsfeld, Cheney, Wolfowitz concept, but it's been taken up by successive Democratic and Republican administrations. As far as foreign policy is concerned, there's only one party, the War Party. As Tanzania's first president, Julius Nyerere, famously said, the United States is also a one-party state, but with typical American extravagance, they have two of them. What does this new Cold War look like right now in December 2022? It involves this NATO proxy war in Russia, which the US wants to draw out as long as possible in order to weaken Russia. It involves the unprecedented sanctions that we've been talking about. It involves NATO expansion. It involves AFRICOM expansion. It involves the deepening of the criminal blockade against Cuba. It involves so-called decoupling and trade war against China, along with the creation of AUKUS, a continuing campaign of China encirclement, the permanent threat of nuclear annihilation against North Korea. And all this to preserve a favorable business environment for American capital, so that a degenerate and moribund social class can enjoy cheap and easy access to land, resources, labor, and markets. But there's good news. The good news is the world has changed, and we can already see cracks emerging in this Cold War alliance. Even though the West has imposed these massive sanctions on Russia, actually, they're hurting Europe far more than they're hurting Russia. Russia can find other buyers for its energy. Virtually no developing country has joined in with the sanctions, not India, not Pakistan, nor most of the countries of Africa and Latin America, certainly not China. China-Russia relations are better than they've been since the mid-1950s. Stoking conflict between China and Russia has been an invariant of US foreign policy on an explicit and well-understood basis of divide and rule. Brzezinski talks about this in his Grand Chessboard book, very important book, and I recommend people to read it if they haven't already. He warns that the most dangerous scenario would be a grand coalition of China, Russia, and perhaps Iran, an anti-hegemonic coalition. Well, sorry, that's exactly what's happening. Meanwhile, very few countries in the world can take the idea of decoupling from China seriously. China's the number one trading partner of more than two-thirds of the world's countries. Around 140 countries are participating in the Belt and Road Initiative. Even Europe can't take part in decoupling from China and Russia without engaging in what is essentially economic suicide, which is why Germany is already starting to roll back on its commitment to sanctions, and why Olaf Scholz was the first Western head of state to visit Beijing since 2020. The inescapable reality is that imperialism is in decline. The internal contradictions of this new Cold War alliance mean that it can't go on much longer. Meanwhile, the socialist world, led by China, is on an upwards trajectory once again. The rise of a multipolar world order is ultimately unstoppable. Thank you.
That was Carlos Martinez, author of China, Sanctions in the New Cold War on China, in the new anthology, Sanctions, A Wrecking Ball in a Global Economy. For more information on the book, and how to join the international campaign against sanctions, see the Sanctions Kill Coalition's website, sanctionskill.org. And that concludes today's edition of COVID Race and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by Polina Vasilia and myself, Ann Garrison. Music was Sanctions by Mitra, and Planet Drum Song by King Clave, featuring Mickey Hart from Playing for Change Around the World. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, covidtaskforce.pacifica.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter, at PacificaCRD, and on Facebook, at COVID Race and Democracy. I've been your host, Ann Garrison. Thanks for listening.